Okay, good evening. My name is Claire Gladrad. I'm the Acting Mayor of Kingborough, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all to tonight's Council meeting on Monday the 4th of May 2026, and welcome to those in the public gallery. Could you please make sure that your mobile phones are turned onto silent? It is 5:30 p.m. and I now officially declare this meeting open. Council now operates under the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025. Under these, I am required to advise you that A, an audio or audio-visual recording is being made of the meeting, and B, all persons attending the meeting are to be respectful of and considerate towards other persons attending the meeting, and language and conduct at the meeting that could be perceived as offensive, defamatory or threatening to a person attending the meeting or listening to the recording is not acceptable. The audio recording of council meetings is made publicly available on our website and meetings are live streamed on YouTube. I will now ask staff to confirm that the audio recording has started. Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, the Muwinina people, and pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Attendees this evening, we have myself, Acting Mayor Councillor Gladrite, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson and Councillor Street. From staff this evening, we have the Chief Executive Officer, Mr Stewart, the Director of People and Finance, Mr Spinks, Director of Engineering Services, Mr Mackey, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, Director of Environment, Development and Community Services, Mrs Shakuti, Manager of Environmental Services, Ms Quinn, our Lead Strategic Planner, Mr Stander, Senior Statutory Planner, Mr Huang, Communications Officer, Mr Heather, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton. We have an apology this evening from Mayor Paula Reet. I'd now like to hand over to the CEO, who would like to make a statement.
Thank you. Before moving into tonight's agenda, I just wanted to provide an update on the cyber incident that was recently identified by Council. So Council became aware on 30 April of a cyber incident involving limited data. We acted immediately to remove access to that information and commenced an investigation, engaging independent cyber security experts to help us fully understand what had occurred. Based on the investigation to date, the information involved primarily relates to property addresses and associated owner or occupier names. There's some indication that a small number of records may also have included email addresses. Importantly, the data did not include any financial information, identity documents, date of birth, or other highly sensitive personal details. I want to reassure the community that the data is no longer publicly accessible and there is no evidence of misuse and Council's core systems were not compromised. A detailed forensic investigation is underway to understand the full extent of the incident and we're working closely with specialist cybersecurity advisors and have notified relevant authorities, including the Australian Cybersecurity Centre and the Tasmanian Police, to ensure the matter is managed appropriately. To date, there is no evidence that the data has been used in any malicious way, and we have established monitoring via an external firm of the internet and the dark web for any indications that the data is being transferred. We understand that incidents like this are concerning for the community, and I want to be clear that the Council is taking the matter very seriously, and we are committed to being open and transparent as the situation continues to unfold. As part of that investigation and approach, we are providing updates through our website, and once the investigation is complete, we will write to any affected individuals with clear information and advice on next steps. Council services continue to operate, and I would like to acknowledge the professionalism of our staff in responding quickly and maintaining service delivery during this time. Finally, I want to apologise for the concern that this incident has occurred. has caused. We will continue to update the community as more information becomes available and we'll be ensuring the integrity of the investigation is maintained. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're on page one, confirmation of minutes. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Cordova, seconded Councillor Bain, that the minutes of the open session of Council meeting number 7 held on the 20th of April 2026 be confirmed as a true record. All those in favour and against, motion is carried unanimously. We're on page two. Workshops held since the last council meeting. On the 17th of April, we had a budget workshop. Declarations of interest. Does any councillor have an interest they would like to declare? Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I'd like to declare an interest with item 12.2 and I'll be leaving the room.
Thank you. Any other declarations? Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open session? Nope. Questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public wish to ask a question without notice?
Mark Dunellan, Huntingfield. A light-hearted question for you, Acting Mayor, to start us off with. The Whitewater Creek track is very popular and sees a lot of movements each day. Last June, the council's public counts that are public counted 450 movements a day at the outlet underpass in June 2025. I would guess a lot of those movements are going to be before and after work, and at that time of year it gets very dark. What level of investigation has gone into provisioning lighting for the path? There be... Let's go with that one first. What level of investigation...
Thank you. Mr. Smee.
Staff have undertaken some preliminary investigations into the provision of lighting. It's not simply as straightforward as just whacking in some solar bollards. It is a wildlife corridor, so it needs to be sensitive to that fact. But they are preliminary. There's yet to be a fully developed business case or inclusion within our capital program.
Further questions?
Thank you. That answered most of the rest of my question. What are the chances finance to progress that will be included in this year's financial year budget?
Mr. Smee.
Nil.
Further questions from the public? If you could please just state your name and your suburb, please.
My name's Jennifer Lawrence, and I live in Kingston. This is regarding the dog park. Will the council guarantee that the new dog exercise area and amenities will be ready for use on, I think it's the 31st of May or 1st of June when the other one closes? And if not, what suitable arrangements, alternative arrangements, have been made or considered, for example, extending the use on the current one?
Mr. Smee.
The intent is certainly to have the new facility at Maddox Road open to coincide with the closure of the one at Kingston View Drive. I can't give a guarantee on that because there is a planning permit that is needed to be issued before that work can be done. And in relation to the second part of your question, that is certainly a consideration, but we would need to look at the timing of the works and the required starting period for those works.
Okay, well, my second question. As your website states that the new areas will provide similar levels of amenity and accessibility for the community to enjoy with their dogs, will there be the same facilities that are at the current dog exercise area, including waste bins, provision of dog waste bags, toilet facilities for dog users, clean drinkable water, and possibly relocation of seating currently at the old park to the new park, and things like weather protection for users, as on your plan, the only shade provided is from existing trees and there are none in the small dog area, which is quite often frequented by elderly people.
Mr. Smee.
It is certainly Council's intention to provide a like-for-like facility. However, it won't be possible to provide all of those elements immediately, given the nature of the timeframes and the work required.
Further questions?
about 2 years, but okay. How long is the lease with TAS Networks for the new area? And what is the council's contingency plan should TAS Networks decide to amend or cancel that lease, as the dog exercise park is a social amenity for its owner, the dog owners, as much as the dogs?
Mr. Smee.
Off the top of my head, I think it is a 5-year lease. Council's contingency would be that there are new public open space areas that are being opened up as part of the Huntingfield development, and if in the event that the TAS Network site was no longer available, we'd look to develop an alternate site in one of those new areas that's being opened up.
Right. Is that something that the council's looking at in future?
Mr. Smee.
We are looking at the potential for that to be a contingency option in the event that the TAS Network site is no longer available, but there's certainly no indication at this point in time that there is any time pressure in relation to the Maddox Road site.
Further questions?
Hello, I'm Marianne Dwyer and I live in Blackmans Bay, and my questions are about the dog park as well. How many dogs does the Kingborough Council have registered?
Mr. Smee.
Roughly 6,500.
Do you think that it is possible that the industrial site of the proposed block will turn people off from using it?
Mr. Smee.
Very difficult for me to speak on behalf of what other people might think, but certainly the indications to date are that our engagement through the Kingborough Dog Walkers Association is that it's a very good site and will meet the needs of people looking to exercise their dog.
Right. Is the site you are proposing flat enough for the elderly and people with disabilities to walk around and exercise with their dog as they have been able to at the other park?
Mr. Smee.
Yes, it is. It's actually flatter than the existing site.
From the road.
Further questions?
Thank you. Bernard Dwyer from the same place as Marianne, Blackmans Bay. Again, about the dog park, it's been documented in the latest DA application that the dog park would only be open now in daylight hours. So that would stop people if that's applied, that would stop people exercising their dogs after work, certainly in winter. And there was a comment made in the DA that it was required, that wouldn't require lighting, and obviously we don't have lighting at the current dog park at any rate. So I'm interested in your thoughts on the only daylight operating hours.
Mr. Smee.
That would be a condition of the planning permit, but the permit hasn't been issued, so I can't confirm that that would be a condition, but I'm assuming that would be the case.
Further questions?
So it would be a case, sorry, I'm just seeking clarification on that, so it would be the case that it would only be in daylight hours?
If that was a condition of the planning permit, yes.
Why does the development application not include the facilities that were requested and actually documented in the survey that we all recently completed? There is no facilities other than three taps, basically, on that DA application.
Mr. Smee.
The development application relates to use. It doesn't necessarily detail all of the facilities that will be included. Those facilities don't require planning approval. It's the use, it's the change of use that requires the planning approval. Mm-hmm. So the development application shows a conceptual set of plans and doesn't necessarily detail all the facilities that will be included as part of those plans.
We would look forward to seeing that in public, all the facilities.
Mr. Smee.
As indicated earlier, the intent is to provide a like-for-like facility, and as I noted earlier, some of those facilities will be developed over time and won't be immediately available, but the intent is to make the facility as desirable as possible from day one.
So, Mr. Smee, could you maybe just let us know what will be there from day one?
I'm not the project director on this one, so I don't know in detail. I don't know if Mr. Mackey has more detail on what will be there, but certainly I can say there will be a fenced area, there will be car parking, there will be water, there will be seating.
Further questions?
Yeah, so, and my last question, and it goes to the timing. In fact, as you've just mentioned, the planning application hasn't been finished. So how can the current park be closed in the end of this month, 2 weeks away, and the development application comment hasn't been closed yet to the 7th of May, and then there's a process, obviously, for that DA to be approved, and the park be closed and no facility provided for considerable number of people that use that every day?
Mr. Smee.
I think it's important to note that this is not the only dog exercise area in Kingborough. There are 13 other off-lead dog exercise areas that will be available. It is our intention to provide a minimum delay with respect to the opening of the new, and there are alternate dog exercise facilities available within the municipal area for what will be a very short period of changeover.
Further questions?
I think that's my three. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions from the floor, from the gallery?
There's more. She forgot her glasses, so she wants me to read it. Is
that all right? That will be fine, yes, no problem. Maybe you could just let us know your name, so it's on behalf of...
Okay. I'm Kathleen Shaw, and I'm from Blackmans Bay.
Thank you, Kathleen Shaw from Blackmans Bay.
Okay. She's got, why has only minimal car parking been included in the plan for the new area, as there are often something like 14 to 15 users and their cars at the current area? So there's only 10 on the plan, and where are the extra going to park?
Mr. Smee.
The car parking that's been provided is consistent with our observations in relation to the number of users at any one time of the current facility. So we believe that the car parking is adequate for the particular numbers that will use the facility at any one time.
I'll make a comment, but I'd like to say, when did you make those observations? Because there were 16 cars down there yesterday morning. As dogs have fun when they're running around exercising and playing with one another, they can be boisterous and bark quite a fair bit. What's the council's position if they receive noise complaints from the residents of Hollyhock Drive, Henwood Drive and any other nearby streets once this new area opens?
Mr. Smee.
We've had a expert noise consultant provided advice in relation to the development application and provided specific advice in relation to the noise of dog parks. So we have a dog exercise area in Taruna, for example, that borders residential areas. There's been noise monitoring undertaken at that and other facilities, and those noise levels have been provided as part of the development application, and as part of that noise assessment are not considered to be unduly excessive in relation to a nuisance to adjoining neighbours.
So, as an add-on to that, if noise complaints came in, the council wouldn't be looking to shut it down, shutting down the area?
Mr. Smee.
If we receive noise complaints, we will need to deal with them in accordance with our legislative obligations under the various acts that exist, but I can't give an answer in relation to what council will do because it's speculative. But if we receive complaints, then we would monitor and act on them in accordance with the legislation available.
And the last question is, why is the council prioritising the needs of a sporting corporation and a group of individuals from interstate over the needs of its own constituents and ratepayers, whereby you're saying that this park is going to close and you are hopeful that the new park will be available and that there are plenty of other places to go? But the people use this park, as I said, as a social gathering as well as for their dogs, and all of a sudden by the end of this month we're not going to have anything down there. And I would like to just ask, when is development work going to start on that area, and do we need to vacate that area on the 31st?
CEO.
So you answer the first bit of your question in terms of the balance of priorities here. Council obviously needs to weigh a number of drivers when we make decisions. Obviously, the development of the AFL Training and Administration Centre is something that Council has seen on a balance to be something that's really positive for our community, both in terms of attraction of economic development into our community, the pride that Kingbra can have as being the home of the Tassie Devils, and as well as the development of sort of aspiration for kids playing sport to seeing high-level athletes within our community. We're really aware of some of the impacts that it does have, and so hence the development of other facilities to be able to accommodate users such as dog walkers at an alternate location. So the Maddox Road location is seen as somewhere where we can do that work in order to provide similar facilities to enable people to continue to be able to recreate, socially connect and exercise their dogs. In terms of when the work will commence, look, as has been answered already, there's a development application that's currently advertised that needs to go through the process, and we need to assess that on its merits. Following on from that, it's planned that if it is approved, that the work commences really quickly so that we can make sure that we're providing our community with the amenity that they would expect from Kingbra Council. I will also point out that, as has been mentioned, there are 13 other off-lead dog exercise areas around Kingbra. So even if there was a lag between the facility closing at Kingston View Drive and the new one opening on Maddox Road, that there are alternative locations. I understand that mightn't be ideal, but it would be for a minimum period of time.
So, CEO, is it really essential that we shut down the existing park at the end of this month? Could it be extended by a week or so?
We're continuing to monitor, I guess, the timeframes. I can't make any commitment to that now. Obviously, when there's contracts issued, there's penalty clauses if, for example, we were then to delay commencement. And there's preparatory work that needs to be done by contractors and things like that. We'll continue to monitor the situation. Look, we want a good outcome for our community through this project, so we're continuing to do everything we can to make sure that we deliver that in the best way we can.
And what about fast-tracking the DA? Is that a possibility?
Look, I don't think there's any options here to fast-track the DA. It's advertised at the moment. It's depending on the level of representation that comes through here. It will either be approved under delegation if it meets those criteria, or it would come to council as the planning authority to make a decision on. I would suggest it will likely be the latter, and then we need to follow a good process here. I don't think it would be appropriate for council to follow one process for us and one process for others in our community.
Any further questions?
Joel Hodson, Middleton. Heading back to our wonderful LPS, heading back again to the issues surrounding Crown Road Reserve access, I don't think the information was ever publicly provided through council meetings regarding when you received information and then we're going to forward it on post Irene Inc. report. I'm not sure if it ever came. I know stuff went to club, but I don't think anything ever was answered here to my question regarding that. To do with that, I wonder if there is, within the performance criteria of the various zones that are affected, the language can be quite vague, and uncertain for residents. So, you know, it suggests having regard to, which to me reads quite subjectively. Can council give some indication of how you will look at this issue upon a development application being handed into council?
Ms. Chikudi.
I'm actually going to pass to our lead strategic planner, Mr. Stander. He is a lot more in the detail of this one.
Mr. Stander.
I'm going to move this a little bit closer. Thank you for that question, and you're quite right. We have been sending out information around access arrangements on some of the proposed new zones. So the access arrangements essentially affects three different zones. It's the landscape conservation zone, the agricultural zone, and then also the rural zone. In essence, what it is trying to establish is a permanent access arrangement for properties. So, you know, from that premises, it would make sense. I guess the tricky part of this is in the past, some councils, and including Kimbra, dealt with access arrangements a little bit more in a flexible way. Under the Tasmanian planning scheme, the standard provisions are quite explicit. So we have been engaging with both the Commission, Tasmanian Planning Commission, the State Planning Office, and we also spoke with NRE, who's responsible for Crown Roads. So I think the best way most probably to go ahead and answer your question is to potentially take this on notice and provide a response in the next agenda. And on top of that, I think it would be appropriate to provide something on our website that can be sent out to all affected landowners.
And possibly in the newsletter as well that goes out.
Yeah. So you're not sure yet what?
I do. I can potentially give you the information right here, but it's quite a lengthy response from NRE. And in essence, I can give you a bit of a summary. There's essentially two ways people can obtain access to the properties. So it's through licenses. These are relatively a quick and expensive exercise, but unfortunately they're temporary. And so that's the problem with the new Tasmanian planning scheme. It seeks to obtain a permanent access.
I guess, sorry, to clarify, yeah, I understand the process. I think we all understand the process now about how the new licensing that we need to obtain and ownership of the road. It's more the standard that council development, that council will require the road to meet in order to satisfy the performance criteria of, for instance, 20.4.3. So, you know, having regard to the length of the access, suitability of the access, topography, the performance criteria doesn't give anything. Are you looking at the bushfire code and how the road access needs to meet that? Are you looking at other codes? How do we know what we need to do to make a road?
Mr. Stander.
I understand your question, and look, I'm just going to say I'm not a development assessment officer, so I'm most probably not the right person to ask that. But I think the advice that I've received from numerous people, it's a case-by-case assessment. Unfortunately, I don't think there's going to be a pretty straightforward answer, but perhaps to answer your question, it might be appropriate for me to go away, take this on notice, and provide some feedback that we can not only put in the agenda but also circulate through our newsletter.
Yeah, it'll definitely be at people's hearings with the TPC, so be good to if council has some answers by then. I don't really have too many other questions. I had one question. In the council chamber here, is there any way we can have this lectern somewhere else so when we're asking questions, we're not unfortunately staring at the back of our lovely councillors' heads? I don't know how you three in particular feel about it.
Pretty awkward.
I hate it. I really dislike it.
CEO. I'll get the CEO to answer that one.
But then they have to turn back around to listen to answers. It's not accommodating.
I can try and answer that one for you. Look, the simple answer is we don't have a great alternative. If you look around the room, there's not too many easy alternatives. We could park it in the middle here, but that might get a bit awkward. Look, at some point we might look at how this room's configured. I don't love the way this room sits at the moment because it kind of can feel a little bit difficult to have good
spending too much
good conversation, but you've just touched on the key point, right? It's about how much money we spend. And honestly, reconfiguring the chambers is probably not a priority. We did
the sound
so that make sure that everyone could hear and all that side of things and the digital technology, but the physical environment's probably down the order at the moment. It is something that we might look at some point, though. Thanks for the point.
Thank you for that. I do have another question. Has council been, and this goes back to the data breach a little bit, maybe not so much, has council been looking at or in the process of restructuring their IT department, i.e. outsourcing or changing how it works?
CEO.
Look, I'm not going to comment on our relationship with staff. I don't think it's appropriate
to talk
about that in this sort of context. We are looking to invest in our IT systems for lots of reasons. One, to make sure that we're continually, you know, improving, I guess, our security and those types of things, topical issue at the moment, albeit this not a security breach. In this case, it was a data that was unfortunately available through a link at a period of time. But yeah, look, we are looking to invest into our IT for lots of reasons, to promote efficiency, to improve how we deliver services, to make us smarter and easier for our community to engage with, to improve how processes flow through the organisation. So all of that is something that we're looking at the moment and will be considered through next year's budget.
Investing in or investing out?
It's investing in systems, basically. Internal IT resource is something that will always be important in an organisation like this.
Further questions?
My name is Will Perry. I'm from Howden, and I've just got a couple of questions. Firstly, can Council confirm the duration of the data breach and whether it was identified through an internal audit process or via external tip-off?
Mr Stewart.
We're currently have investigations underway, including digital forensic experts who will be going through data logs and things like that. I'm not in a position to give any definitive answer in terms of duration at this point. That will be communicated subsequently once we know more about that. We initially found out about the fact that there was a cyber incident here through an external notification of council.
Further questions?
Sure. Sorry, what was that? Okay, so it was external tip-off was the answer to that.
Correct.
All right. So I accessed the interactive map mid last week and I couldn't see the attribute table being available earlier in the week. Was it removed prior to notification on Thursday?
Mr Stewart.
I don't know what you were looking
being,
at.
The underlying data is what I mean.
Yeah.
Didn't appear to be available at that point in time.
I don't know what you were looking at when you were looking at the mapping or the data. When we were notified of the fact that there was data available, we toggled that from public to private data. And then have subsequently deleted that file. So that happened on the 1st of May. The deletion.
And my final question, was council asserts there is no immediate evidence of misuse, yet has acknowledged that the data was publicly accessible without authentication and without any mechanism to record access. Given that council has no visibility over who may have accessed the data or what actions have been taken, how is the conclusion of no misuse supported?
Yep, so a couple of points there. We're working through the vendor for the product that's used there to ascertain from logs about how it was accessed. We don't have that as yet to my knowledge, but we're looking to gain that information. In terms of how we can ascertain that it hasn't been used for any untoward purposes, I can't guarantee that. I have heard no reports of that having been used that way, and certainly we've established monitoring for the transfer of data through an external data security agency that monitors both the World Wide Web, the internet, as well as the dark web as well. So we've done that. Additionally, I have notified through the Australian Signals Directorate and the Australian Cyber Security Centre of this incident. So have availed ourselves of law enforcement, essentially, and they work with, so that's a federal agency that work with state policing in order to ensure that this data isn't being transferred.
Further questions?
No, not from me. Thank you.
Hello. Tamika Radkins from Oyster Cove. My questions also relate to the data breach. In response to the data breach, I believe there's been some reviewing of change management processes and one would assume the strengthening of internal governance. Does the council currently have a formally adopted data governance policy? Mr. Stewart.
No, we don't have a formally adopted data governance policy. What we do have is process, and we have updated that process to include an additional layer of approval before data is published into any public-facing system.
Okay, so when was that last independently audited? Mr. Stewart.
I can't say that I know the answer to that. What I will say is part of our ongoing investments into our IT and systems, we're putting a lot of effort into upgrading, I guess, the environment that we operate in. Included within that, there are a number of things that we're doing here to make sure that we're keeping data safe, including engaging external expertise in terms of what our systems and processes look like.
So in terms of that responsibility then, so who is ultimately accountable at that senior level for the protection of the ratepayers' data? Like if we don't have a formally adopted data governance policy, but there is, as you said, something in place, who's ultimately responsible for our data and the safety of it? Mr. Stewart.
The ultimate accountability sits with me. And I take that really seriously. The way I discharge that duty is by working with really competent and skilled people within this organisation to make sure that we're putting all the right things in place, that we're you know, engaging with experts to be able to help guide us. We're staying abreast of what latest systems and processes look like, and we're putting the appropriate investments into those areas to make sure that we're making, but firstly, council a good organisation to work with by making sure that our externally facing systems and processes are appropriate, but also that we're upholding our duty in terms of keeping data safe. I would say that in this instance, it hasn't been an intrusion or a hack or anything of that sort. It's purely a human error.
Which answers my second question, thank you, all the process that have been put in place. So communication and community consultation have been a hot topic in here and around the place, as I'm sure you all know, on many occasions. And we've heard how council have constantly and continuously met the minimum standards and requirements. Can council explain why it considers compliance with only the minimum required standards to be acceptable, particularly given its obligation to protect sensitive ratepayer and community data? Like we, for instance, you know, I found out about this at 9 o'clock on a Friday night on a Facebook post. Mr. Stewart.
So I wouldn't say that we aspire to minimum standards. I think we do our very best to make sure that we're providing appropriate levels of service across the board to our community, so it's not like we shoot for the minimum. In terms of the communications around this, I will point out that I was made aware that there was a potential information with data at 11:15 on that Thursday, and didn't receive any sort of information that would guide us about exactly what that was until about 8 p.m. on that Thursday evening. We then stood up an internal process, and it's really important. Well, sorry, I'd actually stood up the process before midday on the Thursday, but we could go into further detail once we had more information from that evening. What I would say is there's always a process we need to go through. We don't want to deal in conjecture. We want to be sure that we know what we're talking about. When we publicly made a statement on the Friday evening, that was before I had intended to, and it was because it was being talked about on social media. We had to make a statement at that time. At that point in time, we were still trying to ascertain facts in the situation. We had closed off the immediate risk by removing that file and deleting it. So we had closed the risk, and then we were in the investigative phase. Now, we moved to make a statement at that time because, like I say, it was being talked about on social media, but in a perfect world, I would have held that back for a little bit longer to make sure that when I did communicate, I could do it in a way that it was fact-checked and evidence-based rather than responding prior to that. I think that is good governance, and I think that's responsible operation in this case. We had removed the risk and then making sure that we were dealing with the case on its merits. That was informed also by external legal advice about the processes we needed to go through. So to come back to your original point, I think Council has done everything in our powers to uphold our duties and make sure that we're respecting our people of Canberra by communicating in the most effective way when we can.
I agree that the information that was put out by the Council was quite factual, and it was... everything in there just reflected what you said, so that it was mitigated by it was pulled down and so on and so forth. I guess my point is a Facebook post at 9 o'clock on a Friday night, because a trigger had been pulled and you guys had to say something, as opposed to that was already a pre-prepared statement. You could see that it was, it's done during business hours. You have the email address of every ratepayer that you have. That could have been placed into an email as opposed to just a Facebook post. And I just think that it seems minimum, again, when not everyone's on social media. There are people that would be impacted on that could have probably used an email as opposed to a Facebook site post. Mr. No question, just a suggestion.
I respectfully disagree that that would have been the appropriate way of managing the incident in that case. It wasn't just a social media post. It was also a information page that we've established on the website and continue to update throughout this incident. In addition, we have engaged with the media through this to make sure that it was out there in the public realm. We intend on writing to everyone whose data was within this file and informing them of this when we have the appropriate information to communicate.
I had to find out about it because I looked for it. You guys didn't tell me. That's my private information.
Further questions?
Charlie Biggins, Leslie Vale. My questions relate to statutory non-compliance under the Local Government Act, Section 200, abatement notices. According to Section 200, if the GM, or in this case the CEO, is satisfied that a nuisance, these are legal terms, satisfied and nuisance to the public health and safety exist, then he must, under the Act, must issue an abatement notice to the landholders responsible. My first question: Council's logo appears on the geospatial fire risk mapping of this municipality by the Hobart company GeoNeon, mapping that classifies as extreme fire risk the property exposure of many dwellings. What further actions have council taken to satisfy themselves that extreme property exposure to fire risk exists for individual properties in this municipality?
Who's taking this one, Mr. Stewart?
We're going to have to take this one on notice.
Really? Yeah, okay. Two, once council is satisfied that certain dwellings within Kingborough are at extreme risk of fire exposure, then the CEO must abate that nuisance. And upon a landholder's receipt of a fire abatement notice, wouldn't all vegetation removal work required to bring the risk of property exposure for dwellings down below extreme be exempt from council's biodiversity offset payments?
Mr. Stewart.
I'll also take that question on notice, thanks.
Three. Likewise, if council is satisfied that an individual tree presents a nuisance under the definition of nuisance in the Local Government Act to public health and safety upon receipt of a qualified arboricultural assessment, then the GM, CEO, must issue an abatement notice to the landholder as per Section 200 of the Local Government Act. Yes or no?
Mr. Stewart.
I'll also take that question on notice.
Statutory non-compliance. Thank you.
Further questions?
Kim Phillips-Margate. Have changes been made to the Irene Inc. mapping tool deliberately in the last fortnight or so?
Mr. Stewart.
I'm not aware of any changes that have been made to the mapping in regard to the Irene Inc. report.
So I don't know if this is related to the data. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Apologies.
Yeah.
When the mapping tool was first released, if you clicked on a property, it would bring up a little property details box. Can't remember what the actual wording is. And it would show you in words what the Irene Inc. recommendation is, followed by the draft LPS recommendation, followed by what the current zone is. About a fortnight ago, it changed. That box wouldn't come up automatically. If I click on another area of the box, I can get the information to display, but the Irene Inc. recommendation is no longer displaying in words. So the colour is correct, but the words are not there, and it's making it very difficult to do preparation for submissions. So if we could get that information back, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. We'll look into that. I would point out that between the cyber incident and that mapping, I don't believe there's a correlation between those two things.
Similar tools? That's my concern.
It sounds very frustrating, so we'll look into it for you. Yeah. Any further questions from the gallery? No further questions. All right, we are on page two, questions on notice from the public. We had two questions on notice from the public. The first one regarded agent of change from Mr. Nick Booth, and there was an officer's response from Adrian Stander. The second question related to Part 5 agreements from Ms. Natisha Knight and an officer's response from Delise Shikuti. Just a reminder that if you wish to submit a question on notice, you can do so by completing the relevant form on Council's website or by emailing casey@kingborough.tas.gov.au. We're now on page 5, questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? Strangely quiet. Still on page 5, questions on notice from councillors. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from councillors. The open session now adjourns and the planning authority commences at 6:20 p.m. Item 12.1, this is PSA-2023-1, proposed amendment to the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015, site-specific qualification for a hotel industry liquor tasting facility at 360 Lennon Road in North Bruny. There is a recommendation on page 18, and I'm looking, please, for a mover and a seconder. Moved Councillor Midgley and seconded Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. So, yes, as noted, this is a report considering a planning scheme amendment application. It seeks to introduce a site-specific qualification to allow a hotel industry liquor tasting facility at 260 Leonard Road, North Hobart. North Bruny. Don't know why I've got Hobart there. The report is prepared prior to the public exhibition following initiation by the planning authority. I understand the report covers a lot of really important areas in regards to how it fits within the planning scheme amendment process, in regards to the subject site and location, where it fits within Stralis and description of the proposal, that it's the hotel industry, and the planning scheme, relating that to the planning scheme amendment. I understand it has been going on for quite a while, and I'm wondering if staff at all would like to provide a bit more background for the record and just some further information.
Mr. Stander.
Thank you for that question. Yes, you're quite correct. There's quite a fair bit of history to the site. There's been a number of previous permits issued that one could say are similar to what is operating from the site at the moment. However, council became aware of some of those permits that expired, and it became a compliance issue. So in this particular instance, council worked with the landowner or the applicant to legalise the use and essentially to get it through the system. The only way to do that in that particular zone was to propose a site-specific qualification, which is, it's not uncommon to do something like that. I think one of the challenges that we have on Bruny Island is we don't actually have any business zone sites on Bruny Island. So often what you find is businesses operating from different zones, often the low-density residential zone or mixed-use. There's only two mixed-use sites on Bruny Island. And then, of course, the environmental living zone. So the proposal is really trying to legalise the use that's been operating from that specific area. We haven't received any, as far as I know, any complaints about that particular use, so it was considered appropriate to take it through this process, particularly because it's such a low-risk issue. So you will note that the application is in two parts. The one is the planning scheme component, and then the second component is the development assessment application. So the application will be advertised with that draft permit. And I guess any member of the public and the applicant, if they have any concerns with the permit conditions, they have the opportunity to make a submission. At the end of the day, it will be the commission that makes the final decision. So we have to go to the hearing and explain essentially everything that's in the report and justify that site-specific qualification and also the permit conditions.
Further questions?
Thank you. Thank you for that summary. And just to note, it's advertised for 28 days. That's via the obligations in the paper and then the signage at the site. Is that correct?
Mr. Stander.
Correct.
Further questions or contributions? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. The, I have a question around this site-specific qualification that's been applied, which is great. Are those parameters drafted broadly enough to give the operator some genuine flexibility to expand or adapt the legitimate tourism use over time? Or are they restricted to some very specific use cases?
Mr. Stander.
Thanks for that question. There's most probably two parts to that question. First of all, the wording that we've got in site-specific qualification was actually designed with the applicant. So it was a bit of, council had a proposal and got back to us. There is a level of flexibility in that proposal, but I think the main thing is there's a little diagram in the planning scheme amendment that confines the use to that specific area. But other than that, it will depend on what they want to do in future. But there is a level of flexibility, and I guess there's nothing stopping them from coming back to us in future if they need to expand that.
Councillor Antoli.
And one final question. And during this entire process, what sort of written clear guidance are we giving the operator during this entire assessment process so that they can stay within the rules?
Mr. Stander.
Just to maybe clarify the question, are you talking about post-approval or pre-approval?
So once this amendment is initiated, will the operator receive some clear written guidance on what they may or may not do during the exhibition and TPC assessment period?
Mr. Stander.
So they're not left in a position of continued uncertainty about what the operational status is?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. So I've been personally in contact with the applicant throughout this process. They know that the report is up on the agenda tonight, and, after the meeting, I would establish contact with them again. So give them some options in terms of if they have concerns with some of the permit conditions that they can put in a submission. I guess in terms of the process going forward, if the Commission supports the application and they endorse the permit, essentially change that, we can certainly provide some advice from that, noting that the applicant engaged a planning consultant, and I'm pretty sure that consultant would be in a process to explain everything to them in detail if they can't receive any information from Council. Not that we would hold any information.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. Look, I'm really happy with the way this has worked out. I'll support this initiative. Obviously, this site-specific qualification pathway exists precisely for these sorts of tricky situations where they have a legitimate tourism use, but that serves the community, serves our LGA, but doesn't fit neatly into the current zone. I'm assuming under the new LPS it will be fine, is that correct?
Mr. Stander.
The transitional provisions will allow us to convert it through to any other zone. So there's multiple ways to go about it, but I guess that's the idea is that we carry it forward.
Okay. Great, thank you. That's all from me. Thank you.
Further contributions? Councillor Bain and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Just a question here around timeframes. Would the expectation be that this process would be complete before the TAS planning scheme comes into play, and therefore this would then just flow straight into the TAS planning scheme?
Mr. Stander.
That's a question I get quite on a regular basis at the moment, because we do have a couple of applications for planning scheme amendments. I can't really give you an answer on that one. Planning scheme amendments tend to take long to get through the process. It's not necessarily something that council have, the control over, because if council support this application tonight, we have a formal obligation to put it on exhibition. Then it's really up to the commission once they get the feedback from council on their submissions when they want to schedule a hearing. I would suggest, yes, we're in the first part of the year, so it gives us 6 months. So in all practicality, I think at this point in time, yes, it will get in before the new planning scheme.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you. So just to clarify, though, if it isn't complete, it's not an issue?
No, we can proceed with that application, and we will deal with it, depending on the time frame, whether it's after or before.
Yeah. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Just a quick endorsement to say that I support it, and the reasons are outlined in the report, but I just wanted to draw attention, I guess, to the importance of Bruny Island as a key tourism destination, and so supporting small-scale, high-quality tourism ventures is obviously a good thing. With regards to 6.12 and the environmental impacts, I know we'll speak more about that further along in tonight's agenda. But I think that what gave me comfort was despite the fact that there will be some existing habitat disturbance associated with access and car parking works. More broadly, priority biodiversity values will be retained and long-term environmental outcomes won't be compromised. And that has to do with tree protection measures and other recommended mitigations. So I think this is a good example of where, obviously, it's a 6.7 hectare lot and there are environmental values, obviously, in that vicinity. But this is an example where two things are not mutually exclusive, that you can have both, good quality small-scale tourism developments aligned with beneficial environmental outcomes. So I support the recommendation. Thanks.
Thank you. Further contributions? No. In that case, Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up? I put the motion as printed up there on the screen. It was moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour and against, motion is carried unanimously. We're now on page 21, item 12.2. Councillor Bain has declared an interest. We are considering PSA-2025-2, proposed amendment to the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015, rezoning and removal of the biodiversity protection overlay at lot 100 Spring Farm Road in Kingston. There is a recommendation on page 32 and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Cordova, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. So looking at 12.2, the proposed amendment to the KIPS 2015 for rezoning at lot 100 Spring Farm Road. In essence, I was convinced by the report saying that despite this has been on the market and business hasn't taken up the opportunity, indicating that there will be, it will be served better with the rezoning. And so I look forward to the conversation around the table. Thank you.
Further contributions. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. A few questions. With this rezoning, are there any conditions that are proposed for this amendment that could constrain the scope or design of future residential development on this site? Or is it just the same as any other? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Yep. I think Councillor Cordova answered my second question. And what is the expected timeline from initiation through to the exhibition to the TPC determination? Again, that naughty question you asked before. I probably shouldn't ask it, should I?
It's okay. Mr. Stander.
Approximately 6 months. It could be that these things go through quicker, but we're at the hands of the Commission. Mm-hmm.
Councillor Antoli.
Yeah, again, I think this is another simple one to approve. I think it's, I mean, the site's been on the market without any commercial interest for about 9 years, mm-hmm. I'd say. And that's the market telling us clearly that a business zone designation is not working here. And I think it's great that Council's been flexible and worked with the Spring Farm Village Centre and the applicant to move this on. And residential's clearly the most productive and logical outcome for the land. So happy to oppose to not oppose it, to support it.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Yes, I agree as well. It's great. It shows that flexibility in zoning, having a look at what's working, noting that there's going to be the Spring Farm Village located about 500 metres from the subject site. It makes sense to have that zoning, and absolutely we need housing. So I just guess it shows that we have that flexibility to look at things when things are in place and we first have a vision around this area and the master plan. So it's great. So thanks very much for staff to working with the applicant to achieve this outcome.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Further contributions? Councillor Cordova, did you want to sum up? No, I'll put the motion then as printed on the screen. It was moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour and against, motion is carried unanimously. We're now on page 36, item 12.3. Just wait for Councillor Bain to return. We're discussing the development application for partial change of use to hotel industry liquor tasting facility and associated works at 360 Lennon Road in North Bruny. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Fox. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I have nothing, not a lot to say, just in regards to that does go along with the first one, the First Amendment that we looked at before, and I don't have really anything to say, but I do support this. Again, it was a really great report that outlined the details, the history, and what the business is proposing. Again, I offer staff if they'd like to provide any background or further insight for us before anyone shares. But
Mr. Stander, fancy giving Mr. Rung?
Thank you, May. Currently, I think Adrian, Mr. Stander already provided a comprehensive background about the whole proposal. Technically, this application, this development application, is subsequent application of the planning scheme amendments. So I think, in my opinion, his answer already covered all the background information. Thank you.
Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I just wanted to ask about the 40 spotted pardalote habitat with respect to the white gum, the Eucalyptus viminalis and the Eucalyptus globulus that will be disturbed or have been disturbed as a result of the parking arrangements and the proposed access works. So specifically, I mean, I'm getting that information from page 53 of our agenda. This falls within E10 Biodiversity Code, E10.7.1 Building and Works. Basically, the question is, can we be reassured that the environmental impact is minimal? And also, can we, like, what other measures can be taken to protect 40 spot habitat on this site?
Mr. Huang.
Thank you, Mayor. Currently, so this application was provided with a relevant ecological assessment or arborist report prepared by qualified and experienced people. And it has been reviewed by our environmental planning coordinator. And just based on our professional opinion, if we are satisfied, it meets the relevant performance criteria. Relevant ecological effects could be minimized through appropriate condition as well as through their assessment. Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you for that. Through you, Mr. Mayor. So the question then becomes, assuming that that environmental assessment was undertaken, does that mean to say that the reason why there aren't additional conditions in that relate to protection of 40 spot is because it wasn't deemed necessary? Otherwise, they would appear in the report, right?
Mr. Huang.
I think, in my opinion, I'm not an environmental planner, because it has been already reviewed by our environmental planning coordinator, so it should be all right. Could see. Also, in the future, they will be. The application will be carried out in accordance with all the application documents we approved. Also, including any recommendations provided in the all the environmental assessment reports. So, in the future, the effects could be minimized.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I'll just conclude my remarks by touching on, I guess, some of the topics I raised before around the harmony that can exist between tourism developments that don't have a mega impact on the environment and really Bruny Island being the jewel in the crown that it is. I think it is pretty interesting seeing the translation effect of having. So when we moved to the new planning scheme, I think it's worth noting the proposed zoning of that lot and then seeing that we can actually still have, liquor tasting experience. I think it's a good example of how Bruny Island is this amazing mosaic of both incredible natural beauty and environmental values, but also really interesting and bespoke artisanal tourism experiences. That's, I guess, what makes Bruni so valuable and interesting, and it's businesses like these that attract so many people to Bruni. So it is good that we're able to have flexibility there to encourage both economic development but also environmental, protecting environmental values as well. So I wish them well, and I support the motion. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you very much. Can I ask some questions about the conditions? So condition two closes the premises at 5 on Sundays and public holidays. Why is that?
Mr. Huang.
Because they are preparing, because the reason why the infringement, one of the infringements that's triggered discretion, is they would like to operate their wine tasting facilities during weekend. And so therefore, even though they just prepare, what they're proposing is from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. throughout the week, but we just provide them some flexibility just based on our permit standards under our acceptable solutions. So just in case, for example, if they would like to change their idea or slightly extension their operating hours in the future, so we can also provide them some leeway.
Councillor Antoli.
So the 5 p.m. closing time is not a restriction for them, it's actually an extension, is that correct?
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. And if they want to do a function or something that's after that, how do they maybe look at asking for an extension? Because under the new planning scheme, if I'm correct, it's actually 6 p.m. that they can close to, and what's the harm in extending it to that, giving them the flexibility? Since we're moving into the new planning scheme and the most closest neighbour is 130 metres away, it's not going to affect their amenities. Can we give that to them or what? And it just keeps them in alignment with where things will go.
Mr. Stander.
That's a very good question. The permit will continue to exist, so they can act on this permit no matter whether we're going through to the new planning scheme or not. So essentially this permit replaces the provisions in the planning scheme. I suggest if they wanted to extend the hours, they could approach council for modification of this condition, if it's something that we want to do on a more permanent arrangement. If it is a once-off, I'm most probably not the best person to talk about that, but I do know in other states there's possibilities for getting a temporary permit in place to do that. But my approach would be is to suggest a modification to this condition if that's something that they would look at in future.
So it's flexible.
Councillor Antoli.
Yeah, thanks. Can I ask a few more things?
Mm-hmm.
Condition six is, am I reading this right? Is it imposing a blanket prohibition on all site signage?
Mr. Stander.
I'm not a development assessment officer, but the way I read it is essentially if the planning schemes requires a permit, it will require a permit to go through the DA process, but we have to remember the planning scheme also have a number of exemptions that applies to signage. So there's possibility to put up signage without coming back to council. So it just depends on what they want to do.
Councillor Antoli.
So it's not a blanket ban, or it is?
I would say not.
Okay, because the way it read to me, it sounded like a blanket ban, which I didn't think was actually. I thought that was a much heavier restriction than the planning scheme permits. Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying. Conditions 8 and 9 require work details to be submitted to and approved by council before commencement, but neither condition. This is the crux. But neither condition specifies a time frame for council to respond. Is there a time frame for council to respond? I suppose there are this causes the operator's delay. So they have to meet conditions, but what's the time frame for us?
Mr. Huang Stander, who would like to answer?
Currently, we don't. Unfortunately, council do not have a time frame to respond, but our engineer our other professionals, including planner, engineer, and the environmental planners, will respond as soon as possible, as long as we've got time to respond, and we will respond immediately.
Councillor Antelli.
Because currently there's no legal time frame for this one, for any time frame, but we will do our best to deliver the best customer service.
Councillor Antelli.
Thank you. My concern is that without a response time frame, the operator is has no recourse if council takes an extended period to review submissions and the permit effectively cannot be activated.
Mr. Huang.
Can we throw something in, 14 days or something? Is that permitted?
Look, I must really would suggest that council, obviously, this is a compliance matter, so we want it resolved. So I would suspect that council will actually give it a level of priority. I don't necessarily think we need to elaborate on the condition. It's just one of those matters that we want resolved, and you will pick up in, I think in both reports, we've indicated the urgency to get this resolved. So I don't suspect there would be any delays.
Mm-hmm. Councillor Antolli.
Thank you. Good to get your commitment on the record on that one. Fantastic. And a final quick question about condition 13, the car park. What's your view on it, given that this is a 9-space rural gravel car park servicing a small tourism business, why these sort of car park servicing, why these infrastructure grade standards, are they proportionate to the scale of the business in your view?
Mr. Stander.
Look, I did approach our engineers. It is a standard requirement, regardless of whether it's on Bruny. I think one of the things that we need to acknowledge is Bruny Island is different. If you look a lot at some of the other operators on Bruny Island, they all have these, let's call it, informal parking areas, gravel areas. So the conditions are standard, but the outcome would be very similar to those. So I think it would be unreasonable to allow one operator to do one thing and another operator something different. As I've mentioned before, I guess if the applicant have an issue with this particular condition, they have the opportunity to raise that through the exhibition period, and it's something that we then could discuss at the Commission. The Commission will be making the final decision on the permit conditions, and it's up to their discretion whether they proceed with the conditions as Council proposed. They could potentially remove them or modify them too.
Okay. Councillor Antolli.
Thank you. Look, it's great. I obviously support it. Grateful for you guys working with the operator, and looking forward to more of that cooperation with the Bruny businesses.
Thank you, Councillor Antolli. Further contributions? No. Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up? No. There's a recommendation on page 58. It was moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
And against? Motion is carried unanimously. The Planning Authority now adjourns and the open session recommences at 6:47pm. We're on page 102, item 13, petition still being actioned. A report headed excessive noise from the Salty Dog Hotel, Beach Road, Kingston Beach, will be tabled in a future council meeting agenda. Petitions received in the last period. At the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. Still on page 102, officers' reports to council. Item 15.1, endorsement of council submission, discussion paper on cat management in Tasmania. There is a recommendation on page 104, and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. Move Councillor Cordova, seconded Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. This is a really good development. We have the proposed submission for Kingborough Council in response to the discussion paper on cat management, March 2026. And I'll just take us through the key points before asking some questions. What I found interesting about the discussion paper is that Kingborough Council has named up a couple of times for our proactive cat management, the various provisions or steps that we've taken, and I think that highlights our leadership in the cat management space. Obviously, it's no surprise to anyone that that requires significant resourcing to actually implement. I think the we're at a stage now where, because roaming feral and stray cats are so ubiquitous throughout the municipality, it becomes very expensive and very difficult to deal with them. And so it indeed says in the report or the discussion paper that eradication, total eradication, is not considered feasible, but in various places, like Bruny Island being one, and the other islands around in the Bass Strait, that it is possible there, and so that's where a lot of the attention or resourcing, I guess, therefore goes. I think it's worth noting that the number of people that correspond with Kingborough Council about roaming stray and feral cats indicates that there is significant community interest in this issue, significant community interest in making sure that cats are managed so that the problem doesn't get worse, but also from an animal rights perspective, making sure that we have a humane approach, because it isn't good to have, it's not good for our native wildlife, nor is it good for cat health and well-being to have roaming stray and feral cats around. So that brings me to the key points, and then I've got a couple of questions. Kingborough Council is supporting strengthening the Cat Management Act. It's supporting amending the Cat Management Act to include compulsory cat containment and not to rely on the ad hoc approach of local laws and other instruments to achieve the objective. Supports clearer policy direction and implementation beyond education and guidance. And this includes the introduction of compulsory registration requirements for cats. So my first question is around the distance issue, so the 1 kilometre distance issue around cat trapping. I was just interested to know how the council landed at our position on that particular area, and whether there's any kind of how did council land at what our position is around whether or not to reduce the distance from 1 kilometre.
Thank you for your question. I think council has a lot of experience over the last sort of 10, 15 years on working with landowners, both on Bruny Island very intensively, but also in more peri-urban and urban areas in Kingborough, and that's where how we've come up with what that distance should or shouldn't be. We've also attended forums during the submission period with ELGA, the Local Government Association, and talked to other councils who are also active in cat management in Tasmania.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. The other thing that stood out to me was the issue of, obviously, cat management facilities are critically important. They're not funded to the extent that I believe that they should be. But the cat management legislation requires engagement with those cat management facilities. So you can't just, as a Kingborough resident, see a cat, trap a cat, and deal with a cat. You have to engage with a cat management facility. Those, I mean, I'm aware that in the north they have different funding arrangements for their cat management facility there. But down here, we're now in a situation where you have to book in, it costs money, and basically, my question is around my concern is that it disincentivises people from managing cats, because they realise that to engage their cat management facility, well, they're going to have to pay for it, they're going to have to book in. Who knows when they're going to catch a cat? Who gets an appointment before they catch a cat? Well, that's what you actually have to do. So my question is, how are we supposed to help our cat management facilities to, like, either reduce those requirements or... how do we work with them to reduce those requirements, or those barriers, I should say?
Ms Quinn.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, ultimately, of course, that is a matter for the Ten Lives Cat Centre, which is the main cat management facility in southern Tasmania. So council would be familiar that through its budgetary process, council has contributed to funding to the Ten Lives Cat Centre over the last couple of years, and are currently considering in the current budget whether to continue to do that. And I feel like the role for council is really to advocate to the state the need to fully fund cat management facilities, because the situation that you have outlined is incredibly true. That something that we deal with a lot as council is landowners ring us and either say, I'm about to trap a cat, or I have a cat in a trap, what can I do? Will you come and get it? Or you must come and get it even. And of course council can't do that, and it needs to be that they make the appointment with 10 lives, and often 10 lives can't fit them in. So it is absolutely a barrier. And it's a barrier for council as much as it is for residents. So, of course, we trap cats on our own land and also have to make appointments to go to 10 lives and to pay those fees as well. So it is an important barrier, and I think council should advocate to the state that funding is increased.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Acting Mayor. Final question. is about cat feeding and cat colonies more generally. Is council, look, to be perfectly frank, I'm not aware of the extent to which cat feeding is a problem within our municipality. I've heard anecdotes around Bruny Island and specific areas, but I guess just a broad question, is cat feeding a significant problem for our municipality, and are we making good progress on it?
Ms Quinn.
Thank you. Cat feeding is a very restricted activity, but it can create an awful lot of stray and feral cats. So it is an absolute problem. It is often associated with hoarding type situations, and our previous cat management officer certainly dealt with a whole range of scenarios. But in saying that, we don't know how many. We only are responding to when often it's a neighbour who rings up and lets council know, and then we'll engage with that landowner and find out why they're feeding them and educate them around the reasons not to do that. So I guess it is anecdotal. We are only responding to what we know, but, you know, we might be dealing with one or two a year. But they could be feeding hundreds of cats.
Yeah. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Well, to conclude my remarks, I think that this is incredibly important. I'm actually quite enthusiastic about the steps that council has taken to be quite bold in our assessment of what's going on, and to kind of willingly engage with the process to help advocate to the state government to strengthen the Cat Management Act. There's an enormous amount of community interest in it. I mean, the perspective that I take is one really around the animal rights and the fact that we will have much better outcomes, both for those cats and for the rest of our native wildlife, if we take serious action on this. But just like so many issues with feral animals in Tasmania, these issues do metastasise. The longer that you leave them without adequate funding, the problem gets worse, and it gets worse exponentially. We see that with feral deer as well as we see it with feral cats. So it's something that requires council's commitment to adequately resource and to maintain as a strong priority. I think this is a really good step, and actually the amount of work that's gone in during the last cat management plan, the amount of improvement that's taken place, or the number of actions that have taken place around the state, is pretty incredible and really encouraging. I know that across the ditch in New Zealand, they have an amazing series of programs around feral animal management. And I think we can certainly learn from jurisdictions both overseas and on the mainland. But I think this is one area where the work is really important, and a lot of the work is getting done. So it's encouraging, and I want to thank the team here at Kingborough Council for all the work they've been doing, showing leadership in this space. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further questions? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you very much. Again, I obviously fully support this. It's really important, and I agree with the fact that cats should be registered just like they are for dogs, and I think that will lift compliance as well from the cat owners. Are we being concrete enough in our submission to the state government about funding? Should we put a figure in there? Should we use your 10 lives example, for example? How do you feel about that?
Ms Quinn.
Thank you for your question. Should we be more concrete? I think it depends. It's probably hard to be more concrete. So what if registration was supported by the state government, then I think what this does is say that councils must be funded to provide that service. So one would assume have a registration fee that would partly cover that service, like it does for dogs, but it would bring a lot of compliance activity that would be required by council, as well as, of course, continuing our education programs about responsible cat ownership. So I don't necessarily feel we need to be... I'm happy if council wants to make a stronger statement in that, and that's of course up to council around funding. I feel like we have said that the state government needs to support councils to deliver these actions.
Councillor Antoli.
Knowing how the state government works, I think everyone wants money, but they like it when you have a bit of a plan around it or an idea. So that's just my suggestion. The other question I have is what your thoughts might be about putting in the submission some sort of a request that any mandatory cat management requirements are sort of piloted first with shall we say, better resourced councils before rollout, before smaller councils are forced to absorb unfunded compliance obligations. What are your thoughts about adding that or something like that into the submission?
Ms. Quinn.
On face value, I don't have an issue with that. I don't think it would impact Kimbra Council particularly, putting in that statement. And so I think that is probably something that is up to the councillors to discuss and decide on, rather than probably isn't a matter for technical advice. I think council has done an awful lot of leadership of piloting different tools. We're the only council with a bylaw requiring the containment and registration of cats. We've put out a whole lot of education material. So, I agree with your sentiment. It's probably a council decision.
Okay. To endorse. Thank you. That's all from me on that one.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Councillor Fox.
I do endorse what Councillor Antoli has said, and I wonder whether, in fact, the impact of our cat management officer, particularly on Bruny Island, has been so valuable in educating the community and having a one person who's a real expert in this field. And I'm so sad that that grant has run out. And whether that is would be a better course of action rather than having funding from the state government for education and support, but to actually have funding from the state government again for a dedicated cat management person, because I feel the loss of habitat that has occurred in my experience of living in Howden has been astronomical. The speed with which it's happened is horrific. We've lost our bandicoots, we've lost our quolls, and we've lost a lot of endemic birds and even ringtail possums. And it's frightening. And just to say, let's throw some money at this and do some education and support. The residents themselves need support to be able to get rid of the cats that are doing the damage. I've tried with the cat management officer and have failed. I know there's a family of stray cats on my property and roaming often kilometres around to gather their prey, and together we have failed. And I find it absolutely gut-wrenchingly horrible. But we've got to do more. I feel there's just not enough support for the people who actually want to do something. And education is so important that any stray cats are to be got rid of, and there's no ifs, no buts. Registering cats is a good start, but it's going to take so long. I just feel there needs to be a more short-term response. And how could we possibly do that?
Ms. Quinn.
Yeah, so Council continues to invest in responsible pet management education, particularly around cats. So as part of our natural areas and biodiversity team, we will continue. At the moment, obviously, there's a gap in recruitment, and hopefully we'll replace that person soon. But all our officers are really skilled in providing education on responsible cat ownership. And so we will continue to do that. We've got all the resources. So that was something about, council invested a lot of money early on, and we produced all of the resources, the short videos, the information on the website. And those things are still really current, and we can promote them really easily. And so we will continue to invest in engagement. And I think it's really interesting that with the Bruny Island cat bylaw that requires containment and registration, so that was a real pilot, there is no fee. So the bylaw allows a fee for registration. Council didn't want to at the time put a fee on the cost of registration because we really wanted to incentivise people to register their cats, which they have. So 95% of all known cat owners on the island have registered their cats. Now, they do that freely. We haven't had to fine anybody either. Yeah. So I think their level of compliance is higher because the education has been so good. I think education, as you say, is really key, and we need to continue to invest in it. And I would also, as you suggested at the start, it is really important that the state government continue to fund the regional cat management officers, and it doesn't look like they're going to do that.
We should add that to our to our recommendation that we would strongly urge the state government to fund cat management offices.
Ms Quinn.
You could add it if you wanted, or we could do that outside of the submission if you wanted to do that. But it is it's an important point.
I don't know if the mover would.
Yeah, I would support it, so we just need somebody else to say that they want to amend the motion to add a second dot point that says encourages the state government to fund regional cat management offices.
So, Councillor Antola, you were suggesting something similar, so do you want to...
Yep, absolutely.
So, who could just repeat that, please? Councillor Cordova.
So the dot point would say... So it would be a secondary dot point. So the first dot point is that council endorses the draft submission, yada yada, as is on the screen. And then the second dot point would say council advocates to the state government to reinstate funding for regional cat management offices.
Okay, and that's acceptable to Councillor Cordova and Councillor Fox, so that just becomes the substantive. CEO, I can hear you whispering over there. Are there any issues with this plan?
No, all good.
Okay. Further contributions or questions? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Just to have a quick summary, thanks everyone for their input. It's long overdue. It's great that we are having this discussion paper. It definitely is a very topical thing. And I also applaud Kingborough Council's leadership and mention of all the work that we have done. And with that work has come funding to support the great work that we have done. So. Yes, it's great that I hope that all councils are putting in submission. I know then when I was in Circular Head in Stanley looking at the penguins, I couldn't believe the amount of cats that were in that area. And I guess the local government, you know, hands are somewhat tied in regards to how they can respond to that. So I welcome this and I hope it doesn't take too long to put the action that I'm sure many councils have put forward. Hopefully they can have some sort of agreement. I guess... on that as well, what's like the next process? Is there a time frame? Yeah, probably in the report, sorry. Just remind me again of the time frame and if they come back to us with any thoughts around this.
Ms Quinn.
So the time frame for submissions on the Tasmanian Cat Management Plan is on the discussion paper, sorry, is the 15th of May 2026. And what the state government have said is that they will, of course, consider all of the submissions and then draft a new Tasmanian Cat Management Plan. Yep. So what I would imagine is that some of these initiatives would need to change the Cat Management Act, and that would take longer. But I think the first step is that the new Tasmanian Cat Management Plan has these initiatives in it.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. And I just also want to acknowledge our Mayor, who is very passionate in regards to this topic. And I did actually ask about the date if we could defer this to the next council meeting, but due to the time of the submissions. But I guess through that, people can make an individual response as well in regards to this. So if the community is listening and if you are passionate about this area, please make an individual response or any community organisations. But, yeah, just a big thanks to staff. I thought it was really strengths-based as well, the way that it was written. Thanks so much for their time. And you can really see their experience and all the research they've done close to home around this. So thank you very much.
Further contributions? I just had a question around compulsory registration. Can you just sell your reasoning to us why you've decided to include that in the submission?
Yeah, thank you. Yes. There's mixed views about registration of cats. So registration of cats, if implemented by the state, would be, and rolled out by local government most likely, would look very similar to how dogs are registered, and probably for really similar reasons. So at the moment with cats, there's rules under the Cat Management Act that you must de-sex your cat, you must microchip your cat, and if you have more than four cats, you need a multiple cat permit. But there's no oversight of that process. So because we don't know how many cats are out there because they're not registered. So registration would allow council to have an understanding of the number of cats in our municipality, and we would be able to have annual checks on whether those cats are actually de-sexed and microchipped and contained if containment came in as well. And that is absolutely critical, microchipping and de-sexing, to try to manage the impact of cats, of stray and feral cats, on the environment, on agriculture, on human health. It really is the only way to limit the number of cats. And so registration would allow us to bring a compliance process into that, where currently there isn't any oversight because we don't know what's out there.
Do you think it would... I'm just worried that people won't, and then we have a lot of people who aren't complying. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, thank you. I think the Kingborough community is highly engaged in responsible cat ownership. I think they're very supportive of it. We have had 136 inquiries last financial year just about nuisance cats and roaming cats, and I think the community really want to see that regulation is stepped up, and regulation would be registration, so that we can make those checks, so that those nuisance cats aren't impacting them in the same way. So just in the last 3 months, there's been 83 inquiries from the community to council officers about nuisance cats and stray and feral cats. And I think, I think the community is really ready for registration. Registration is normal on the Big Island, on the mainland. So most states in Australia, registration is normal and it's proved to be useful. So I think, you know, it wouldn't be Tasmania trialling cat registration, or it is a very proven method of tracking cats and ensuring compliance.
Okay, great. You convinced me. Thank you. If there's no further questions or contributions, then I'll put the motion. It was moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Fox. There's a recommendation up there on the screen. All those in favour? And against, motion is carried unanimously. We're on page 145, the appendices, looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Move Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Bain. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions regarding the CEO's meetings, and apologies not stating I was going to ask any questions about this. Homes Tasmania, if you could just give us an update in regards to, what those meetings look like and why you meet with them, please.
Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, thank you. The Director of Environment, Development and Community and I met with Homes Tasmania, including their either new or acting CEO, to discuss, I guess, working together and the relationships. So it was quite a high-level conversation there, talking about how we're going to work together. We talked through some of the DAs that are in place, current and in place for the development in Huntingfield, and talked about a way working forward, which includes fortnightly meetings between council staff and staff of Homes Tasmania to make sure that we're working as closely as possible and enabling a good outcome out of the Huntingfield development.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. If anything does come up in those meetings, it's important for council to know. If that's okay to be briefed on, that would be great, please.
Yes. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. So we have discussed with Homes Tasmania the opportunity for them to have a workshop with council as well, especially around the Huntingfield development, to be able to talk to directly to councillors about the work that they're doing there and provide the opportunity for you to directly ask them some questions. So we've got a pretty busy workshop calendar at the moment, but we'll be looking to set something up there.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Yes, just the meeting with the obedience dog. Sorry, I saw that one before. The Southern Obedience Dog Club. That's the one.
Mr. Stewart.
Yes, just if you could brief us on that, please. How's that going?
Yeah, sure. They came to have a chat with me. So I think it was probably six or so members, mainly off the committee from the Dog Obedience Club. In particular about a way going forward for them in terms of a future home. I guess from a council perspective, we've been working to try and find a new location to house them once they need to move off the site in the sports precinct. We had recommended a site in Lower Longley, which we felt ticked a lot of the boxes in terms of, you know, facilities, amenity and things like that. You know, there's toilets on site, etc. They weren't enthusiastic about that site. So we had a bit of a conversation about where other sites might be. I asked for them to provide their thoughts. At the same time, made it clear that we don't have a limitless number of sites in Canberra, and that, you know, we're open to conversations with them and really keen to help them find a new home, but we don't have limitless options, so we have to work with what we've got. So we had conversations about that, and we also talked about how much of the space they need as exclusive use. So in terms of the site they're in at the moment, they have exclusive use of a large tract of land, and if we're going to be finding them another location, there might be some trade-offs associated with having that dedicated use.
Further questions? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Quick question about the rapid bus strategic business case. Is council... are we supporting that in any kind of material way? And, what's the progress with that?
Mr. Stewart.
So the strategic business case was developed by the state and was publicised before it came to councils. So it was really a briefing of what was contained within that. The reason for that sort of publication without council engagement was there were some timelines that they needed to hit with the federal government in terms of, you know, being able to proceed to the next stage, which is a detailed business case following on from that. So they have intent to work with councils involved. I will say that the strategic business case indicates that the first phase of that work would be in the Northern Corridor area, so sort of that corridor that goes from Glenorchy through to Hobart, rather than the southern area out to here or east across to the Eastern Shore. So really it was an update of what their process is and the work that was contained in that but that strategic business case is available publicly for people to read, and a commitment from the state government to work closely with us in the future.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. That's good to know. The second one was about the Acting CEO meeting on the 30th of March with Minister Vincent in relation to fast-tracking planning scheme amendment for housing purposes. My question is kind of two components to the question. The first is this in relation to the 60-metre squared granny flat or 50% size increase initiative or a separate one? And the second question is, what are we to expect more of these kinds of initiatives that Canberra Council is, for want of a better term, partnering with the state government on fast-tracking housing developments?
Mr. Smee.
So the meeting was, in effect, it was somewhat of a workshop, and the minister flagged that he has a desire to see a faster turnaround for planning scheme amendments that relate to housing development. There was no particular position put on the table. It was basically there was some planning staff in attendance as well, and a bit of a think tank in how to achieve, in effect, fast-tracking of planning scheme amendments to deliver residential developments quicker. So no resolution, no proposal. There'll be further work done on this topic, and we'll come back to council at some stage in the future, but not specifically linked to the granny flat proposal, no.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. It sounds like there'll be more information forthcoming, but I'm just interested to know, does council have a position on the pre-approved designs that some other jurisdictions, it might be Victoria or others, have lists of pre-approved designs that then get fast-track development application approval? Has council had a public position on those kinds of initiatives?
Mr. Smee.
Not a question I could answer, sorry.
Ms. Shakuti, sorry.
Thank you. I don't believe we have a public position. I do know from discussions with planning staff, it's certainly something we are open to. And, you know, if we councils more broadly could work with developers or the state government, whoever's delivering housing, to help design to meet scheme standards for different zones. It would be very beneficial and help everybody. So, yes, very open to that.
Mm-hmm. Further questions on the appendices? If not, I will put the motion. It's up there on the screen. Moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
And against? Motion is carried unanimously. We're on page 145, notices of motion. Councillor Midgley submitted a notice of motion headed Margate to Huntingfield Shared Pathway Project. Moved by Councillor Midgley. I'm just looking for a seconder, please. Seconded by Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I decided to put this motion forward because I guess, what is it, coming to my second term on council, and this was a project that I kind of thought that might have happened during my term on council, but realistically it hasn't. And after the great success of the Margate to Snug, I thought this would be a great follow-on. So during my first year or so with the Mayor, we advocated for some funding to go alongside to do a study in regards to where the pathway would go. And the consultants didn't really complete that job. And then we've had a bit of change in staff in state government who was overseeing that, and because of the changes in funding and positions and things like that, they haven't reinstated funding to that particular urban mobility position anymore. So it's kind of a bit of a holding spot at the moment. There is a consultant re-looking at the project. And I guess with the fuel crisis, I've been a bicycle activist and advocate for a long time, but also I note that during the fuel crisis, like, people have contacted council staff and other cycling advocates to ask, like, when are these projects happening? Where can we ride safely? You know, I want to ride my bike from Margate to a school in Blackmans Bay, or from Spring Farm to a school in Blackmans Bay or Kingston. You know, what is the safest kind of route to go? I know this has been raised every time we meet with the bike committee. People are really interested. If you have not ridden that section of road, like, please come with me one time and we'll see. Like, I rode to soccer from Howden on Saturday, and I really do go, wow, I hope I don't die. Like, seriously, I have that thought before I ride this section of road. But sometimes, you know, when you've got teenagers who are driving, you don't always have the cars, and I've ridden e-bikes for a long time, and I just really hope that people do not speed past me and are patient. I just think, great, maybe you can take a breath while I'm riding and you might, slow down a bit, but that does not always happen. I've know personally a number of people who've had accidents and have been hit actually on that road as well. So I'm not putting this forward for any political kind of, you know, grandstanding. I just sort of had a bit of a moment when we had that extra break between council meetings and thought to myself, right, what are some things that I really want to kind of put forward? And so this is such a project. So, in regards to, though, I did share this with the CEO just to check a few things, but noting the officer's response, I do feel like because the project isn't complete, I think points 3 and 4 probably aren't really relevant, and I think it might be hard to get it across the line tonight. But I do want us as council to recognise that this Margate to Huntingfield Shared Pathway project is a high priority infrastructure project. And I'd like us to name that up so that when we do advocate to federal and state funding, that we do put this as a high priority. And I understand that we have, but I guess I want us to continue that and so to make that statement here tonight with this council. And I guess the second point around advocating to the state government to finalise the designs plans for this project, because that hasn't happened and we need that to happen. We need the project to be shovel ready to do point 3 and then to do point 4. So I've spoken to some of my colleagues in regards to perhaps I can't change anything around this, the points here. But I hope I provided enough information in regards to why I put this forward tonight. I don't want to let it just sort of hanging there kind of, you know, as a side project. I really do see it as a priority project, and I know that it will benefit many people across the municipality.
Thank you for your passionate contribution, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Bain, and then Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. So firstly, I'd just like to propose an amendment to remove recommendations 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm. And is this acceptable to Councillor Midgley and Councillor Cordova? Okay, so we'll take those two out. Thank you, Ms Morton. Councillor Bain.
Thank you. Yep, very happy to speak to this one. It's something I've been very passionate about since well before my time on council, so I thank Councillor Midgley for putting it forward. As stated, I think the second of the four recommendations is such a key first step, and that is finalising design plans for the project, because without having these designs, it makes it extremely difficult to progress the project any further and to advocate for funding. So this project came about following the State Government's Channel Highway Corridor Study, which went out for community consultation in 2019, and the summary report with recommendations was released in September 2020. So we're essentially approaching 6 years since the recommendations were put in place. And just one of the interesting quotes that came from their summary report was, "Of all the options presented, the shared path received the most interest from the community and is strongly supported." Mm. But yet here we are 6 years later and we still don't have designs in place. Mm. And it's interesting to compare that to some of the other state government corridor studies around the state. So if we look at the West Tamar Highway Corridor Improvement Plan 2022, which is only 4 years ago, they've achieved road duplications to two lanes each direction, road widening, improved intersections, construction of new shared paths, separated walking and cycling paths, new crossings and major intersection upgrades. The East Tamar Highway Corridor Improvement Plan, similar story, and the Bass Highway Action Plan also progressing extremely well. Mm. So in my opinion, Council has well and truly held up our part of the equation when it comes to shared paths over recent years. Mm-hmm. To think that you can now go from Firth Side all the way through Kingston Park and along to the Kingborough Sporting Precinct, Spring Farm via shared paths, and that's without having to cross a single major road. We've got the Ogana Road Shared Path Feasibility Study nearly complete to help us connect Kingston and Blackmans Bay. And we've got work continuing to be done connecting Snug with Lower Snug. So I think Council are doing a lot, but this is the key one that's missing, which we need the State Government's help with. So there is no doubt it's going to be an expensive build, but there is examples of similar size shared paths being completed around the state, and there's also no reason why we couldn't split it up into stages to allow small sections to be done each bit at a time. So in summary, very happy to support the recommendation, and I'd encourage my colleagues to do the same.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. Probably need some feedback as to why we removed 3 and 4 instead of modifying 4. From what I can see, the only pushback is we shouldn't be shoving this into the long-term capital works plan until we've got a confirmed funding pathway and project cost estimate. So why would we remove 3 and 4 instead of just modifying 4? And can anyone give me an answer to that? What was that all about? I think we just chopped one leg off and then we've got to hop into this now. I don't think we should have. I think we should have backed ourselves. And to give you some encouragement, Councillor Minge, I think you should have backed yourselves and said, well, if 4 was a bit too hard, can we modify it? Because I think this is a great idea and I think it should be done. Probably should have been done 4 years ago.
Councillor Bain.
In my opinion, the issue with 3 and 4 is it's hard to advocate for money when we don't know how much money we require, because we need the plans in place first to get an idea of how much it's going to cost. Similar with capital work plans, we know we can't put a figure next to things unless we know how much they're going to cost, which requires the plans to be done.
I appreciate the answer. So to me, that's too process focused. You need to be more lobby focused, in my humble opinion. You don't go there, in my humble opinion, you don't go there and say, fund the project and give me zero commitment that you've got any appetite to fund the project. Because once they've funded the project, they're going to do this and say, well, we did what you asked. So I think we need to ask more. And personally, I'd like to make an amendment that we put 3 and 4 back and that we change 4 to simply say, subject to confirmation of an external funding pathway and a project cost estimate. And I think that's perfectly acceptable, and I don't see why anyone would vote against that. Let's have some ambition, put some pressure on the state, and say fund the design, and this is a infrastructure project for the safety of the community, because I agreed with everything that Councillor Midgley said.
So,
any thoughts on that?
Councillor Cordova and Councillor Midgley, what are your thoughts on that proposal?
Thank you, Councillor Ntoli. Reading the officer's response, I didn't think it would get across the line, actually, so that's why I thought it would be best to remove 3 and 4, because we don't have the finalling designs for the project. But I guess if you feel like that would be a stronger advocacy, and putting those statements in with the amendment to a bit more on point 4, I'd be happy to add those, keep those back in. So, yeah.
Is that acceptable to you, Councillor Cordova? Okay. We might just read that out again then for Mrs. Morton.
But it just needs that extra bit to 4,
I think.
Okay, so add this project to Council's long-term capital works plan, subject to confirmation of an external funding pathway and a project cost estimate. Covers both bases.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not march into the state government, God bless them, hopping in like a wounded soldier. Let's go in with some boldness, because I think that's the way it should be. So happy to support it.
Thank you, Councillor Ntoli. So Councillor Fox, Councillor Cordova and Councillor Midgley have accepted it, so we don't need a seconder to the amendment. Are there further contributions, Councillor Ntoli? Sure,
yeah. Can I get any indication from anyone if DSG's indicated a timeline for its next decision point on this project, or has it just gone silent?
Mr. Smee.
I believe it's in a...
Well, there is no DSG.
Yeah, there... it's effectively just in a holding pattern. We haven't been given any commitments on timeframes.
I recommend we get a figurative symbol out and smash it really hard and get their attention and wake them up again. I think the community wants that. And like Councillor Bain said, very, very popular. So let's back ourselves and back the community and go in with this confident.
Further contributions. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. It's a critical piece of infrastructure, and it's certainly endorsed publicly by, you know, many people who want to see this. I just wanted to speak briefly about the shared benefits that we'll see. You know, I spent a lot of time talking about healthy active by design and these kinds of concepts where you can shape your built environment to help people improve health and well-being, and that has concomitant economic benefits because, you know, people live longer and happier and healthier lives, and they don't have as much need for acute healthcare services. On the other side, I think if you're a motorist who just wants to remain a motorist and has no particular interest or appetite to be on a bicycle, these kinds of infrastructure programs are the best thing for you, in the sense that it reduces congestion, it gets people off the roads, and it also separates these road user conflicts that take place where, you know, on a winding single lane road and you're stuck behind a cyclist. That's exactly what people who don't ride a bicycle don't like to see. So I think from a number of different perspectives, it improves health and well-being, but it also improves the commuter experience and the mobility experience for all Tasmanians, anyone who's here, residents and visitors alike. Critically, the success that we're seeing, I mean, if we turn our attention to the bike committee and their minutes, they show that a whole lot of our pathways are really used a lot. They're used a lot not just for recreation and people getting their healthy, active well-being, but they're also just used by commuters getting to and from work, used by young people going to school. So it's just one of those things that makes society much easier to live in when you've got access to really good, safe infrastructure. So I think for the long term, it's a really good move, and I'm very pleased to have supported it tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Fox.
To remind people that there's been quite a lot of concern from residents in Margate about the bridge that goes across Northwest Bay River, and there's been, I think, a petition and a lot of emails floating about that, and it is a real pinch point for both pedestrians and cyclists. And it's interesting that this link would also go right through to Longley, because they're now upgrading the road that goes from Margate to Longley. what's that road called?
Sandfly
Road. Mm. So it all comes together as an amazing infrastructure project that is being put together, and it would close that link, and it would make a marvellous tourist adventure to be riding that route, as well as locals being able to commute and not have, and doing active transport, not having to catch buses, etc., to work or school. So I really advocate that we somehow mention or at least highlight the fact that the North West Bay River Bridge really needs to be included. How can we do that?
Councillor Midgley.
It is part of that, the scope of the study. It does include that as well.
Great.
Yep.
Thank you. I hope the residents hear this. Thank you, Councillor Fox. Further contributions? Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up?
Thank you to my colleagues for their support for this really important project. It's really great to hear. Thank you.
So there's a recommendation on page 145. I'll put the motion. Moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
And against? Motion is carried unanimously. We're now on page 146, and you are going ahead. Yeah, great. So we have a notice of a motion that was submitted by Councillor Midgley, headed Community Garden at Huntingfield. There is a recommendation on page 146, and I'm looking for a seconder, please. So move Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I wasn't sure if I was going to remove this motion just because of some discussion that I'd had further with the CEO in regards to the meetings with Homes Tasmania, but I will keep it on because I'm interested in the discussion as well. So some of us were here when it was Minister Ferguson, actually, was the minister at that time, looking at the fast-tracking of Huntingfield, which was many years ago, and there'll be a home soon, I'm sure. And we did chat about lots of different things, and I guess there was a lot of talk as well around not only just the housing, but the things that sit alongside that. And I guess I'm a passionate person in regards to, social housing and affordable homes. And the biggest thing, I guess, is around, like, social housing is keeping people housed and having that community infrastructure around that site to create community cohesion, a sense of belonging and a sense of community. And so some of the things were raised for this particular open space buffer site that's mentioned. Was a community garden, a men's shed, and other options like that. And I guess I was really trying to advocate to the minister at the time around, and I'd done a little bit of research around the benefits of community gardens for human services worker and for communities, in regards to that if the ideal world, I would love to see that all social housing projects had a community garden, and that they actually paid like for a community development worker to be a part of that. And we now again know with the the cost of living, like the benefits of gardening, the benefits of growing our own food, but on that benefits comes so much social cohesion, getting to know your neighbours, and it's a great activity from early years to older, so it creates that real community bonding. So I guess that was, and we had that little break in the council meeting, it was something else that I'd thought about, but also some residents and some local community members had contacted me, noting that that was mentioned in the master plan and saying that they were interested in being a part of a community garden, and they asked, what is happening in this space and what can we do and what sort of action can we take. So I guess the motion really responds to that. Thank you very much to the staff for their response. I guess the response, I sort of thought, well, I'm not really sure how this will go down as a discussion because I didn't really feel that you know, you're having the high-level discussions with Home Tasmania, and basically housing is the priority at the moment versus kind of the other activities. But again, with that first discussions that we had, I see that, you know, having this community infrastructure in place is actually an important thing to put on the table. And one thing I also wondered was, I'm quite sure, I know it's separate to this, but there was, you know, playgrounds mentioned as well, and I'm sure that the state government was going, or Homes Tasmania, whoever, was going to look at the cost. You know, that wasn't going to come back to council. So we very much in those early discussions did advocate that this was kind of part of this whole package, and because of, you know, changing in staff at both ends, some of these kind of conversations get forgotten. So that's why I kind of wanted to raise it, so it was on the radar, so we're kind of thinking about that. And that's, I guess, the intent of the motion. So I look forward to hearing, my colleagues' comments.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. I think this is another good idea. So I encourage my colleague to keep backing herself and with absolute respect, remind my colleagues that get the advice from the staff, but we decide whether a notice of motion lives or dies, and we shouldn't let the staff decide whether they live or die, because great things can come out of the discussion. I have two questions. The first is, have we got a local hunting field community organisation that agrees with this, that would back us on this, that would promote this with us, locked arm in arm? Does anyone know?
I believe there's one in the room just behind you there.
An entire organisation is in the room.
I believe there is support for this, definitely.
Great, because I think that's what's probably needed to get the blessed bureaucrats moving, because I think they want to see the community involvement. They want to see the engagement. And can this letter to Homes include a specific request for a project timeline and funding envelope? Why not? Have we thought about that?
Mr. Stewart?
Because if we give them vague requests, they fob us off.
Ms. Shakuti, Mr. Stewart?
So I can answer that. So obviously the notice of motion as written doesn't include that, but by all means we can include questions around the intent of this, so we can do that.
Thank you.
Councillor Antoli.
To get some clarity on the... it was a bit vague what you mentioned, Councillor Midgley, about based on the CEO's discussion with Holmes, I wasn't too sure if this was a good idea, was going to get up. Can I miss something? What was that mysterious point or discussion that created doubt?
I think it was just the wording of the officer's response. It wasn't sort of emphatically, yes, let's do this. And I think Councillor Midgley...
But we decide whether it's emphatically done or not, but fair enough. Okay. Look, I support this, and I just encourage my colleagues to... We need more NOMs. It's one of the few things we get to do, and I don't think we've had them for a long time. So I really do encourage... congratulate Councillor Midgley for giving us some two meaty things. I think it's great. Can you imagine the development there? The lots are very small. They could really do with a community garden. How wonderful. As a young family, you've just moved into Hunting Fields, your first home, you've scrimped and scraved, you've got your two little two-year-olds and their trikes, going down to the community garden, pitching in together. I think it's a wonderful thing for building community. I think it's a healthy thing. I do support what you said about some sort of community development officer, but this is not... The Homes Development Hunting Field is not as social housing as probably you're saying. It's a little bit more broad to the community now, so I can't see that funding getting approved, but I agree with the concept. And I just think it's a great idea. There's a little community garden that's sprung up behind where we live. It's by the locals. It's on the flood flats there at Margate River. I have no idea if it's legal. It's fantastic. It's just sprung out of nowhere. Everyone's using it. And I would fight it being shut down, I must say. So I think these are great little things. My kids are too old for this sort of stuff, but it's just fantastic to spend time with your grandkids or your own children in this sort of environment. And I think it's a great idea, and I don't know why you wouldn't support it. It's not going to cost us anything.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Any further contributions? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I too am very enthusiastic about this for the reasons that have been mentioned. It's also, I think, in addition to having the sense of community identity and bringing people together, the social cohesion aspects, I think it's important to pay mind to the social determinants of health as well, and the food deserts. I mean, often it's what we want to be able to do is make sure that for everyone in our community, healthy choices are easy choices. And as the cost of living is getting worse and worse, just the quality of the food, to have good locally grown food. When I get my potatoes and parsnips and carrots from a particular community garden, it's like the food makes you want to sing. You know, having really good food that is grown locally with love makes a big difference, and it also, having these localised food systems is actually what breeds or creates resilience. I think we're all very well aware of the geopolitical circumstances where you say, you know, whether it's from pandemics or from overseas wars, where our supply chain is not as... it's not as resilient as we probably once thought that it was, and it's easy to take that for granted. The best way to take power back and to feel like you have that resilience in your community is to actually grow your own food and have it local and know what goes into it and know what comes out of it. So Taroona, Blackmans Bay, Kingston and Margate, there's amazing work, and all the other ones that are out there, they're doing amazing work and they're growing great stuff. So more power to us, the more that we have, the merrier. So I support this, and thanks everyone for their enthusiasm as well.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further contributions, Councillor Dean.
Thanks, Acting Mayor. I'm just trying to kind of understand a bit more clearly what the outcome of this will be. We are going to write to Homes Tasmania, but we're not necessarily dictating that a community garden should go in this zone, this area that will be zoned open space. And it's going to be a potential option when the land gets handed back to us to manage. So could I just seek some clarity as to what will happen following this being passed?
Ms. Shikuti.
Thank you.
Emphatically.
Okay, I'll be emphatic. Well, if the notice motion is passed, we would write to Homes Tasmania doing what is asked in the notice of motion. I have actually contacted Homes Tas about this. And look, it was a high-level discussion. And essentially, I was advised that they haven't turned their mind to this yet, given trying to get houses built and the pressures around that at the moment. They certainly weren't saying they're not going to do that. It's just right at this very moment it's not a priority in their project planning. It is still in the master plan, so that public open space will eventuate, and with options to use it how the community potentially desires. What we don't know and would need to work through is typically public open space transfers to council. So it will become council land. Then I can't answer how potentially state funding versus council management versus community would work in that situation. I'm sure you could work through that, but I can't predict or, you know, advise on that at this moment. So to be honest, I kind of feel writing to ask those questions may be a bit futile, because I think we'd get the response that I've just articulated. And I wonder whether, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do this, but to suggest an amendment would be around council commencing engagement with Homes Tas to develop a plan for the space, and which could include further community consultation as well.
Community consultation, though, how does that work if there are no homes there yet?
Well, that was sort of another point I was trying to make in my response, is that we need to be clear that Huntingfield has an established community at the moment, and which will be expanded. Mm-hmm. So it's whether, again, we can have a bit more of a detailed plan as to whether we want to progress that consultation earlier with current community or later. I would suggest later is you would end up pushing it out a long time. Yeah, it's a little bit tricky with a few unknowns in there.
So what would councillors like to do? Would you like to amend the motion at all or just go forth? Councillor Dean, I think we were...
Yeah, look, I probably should have framed the question a little bit differently, but I think you've got to the point that I was trying to get at. It didn't really seem entirely that useful to go down the path, but I'm happy to begin the process of re-engaging homestays around the use of the site. So I don't think there's any issue with just supporting it and letting staff, unless we need to really specifically change the wording to the move. I think Mr. Cootie's understanding of where we're at, I don't think we're going to be voting against it, and I appreciate there's positivity for the concept of a community garden. I'm a member of one. I contribute money and grow terrible tomatoes every year and understand that they're really well appreciated, and if the people of the Huntingfield Expansion community want it, go for it. But I think it just needs to be determined and investigated. Mm-hmm. So
is everyone feeling like we don't need to make any amendments but we'll allow staff to carry on in as they will with they seem to understand what we're trying to put forward, or would you like something clearer?
We're happy to articulate in the letter a desire to engage as well, and we can share a draft of that letter with councillors before it's sent.
Fantastic. Thank you. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. I guess just to point out that I think point three is very important to try and get an answer on that, get discussion happening sooner rather than later too, because I mean the budget years do go many years out, so just get them thinking, you know, we're expecting state government to fund all that master plan, including all the infrastructure, the playground. I think they might have made a pump track in there as well originally, so just to make that clear, I guess, in the letter and see if we get a response.
I see nodding heads. Yep, and some raised eyebrows. Further contributions? Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up?
Thank you to my colleagues for the contribution, and also, this initially, it was something that we talked about as many years ago, but also raised again by a community member at a meeting with their passion around food security and their vision for something like this, and so that prompted me then to have a few emails and then put forward a motion. So let's hope this gets the conversation started and that doesn't get, left behind. So, yeah, thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. So I'll put the motion as printed up there on the screen. Moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Cordova. All those in favour and against, motion is carried unanimously. We're on page 147, confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder that in accordance with the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025, Council by absolute majority move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, application of leave of absence, Kingborough Waste Services Board appointments. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Fox. All those in favour? And against, motion is carried unanimously. In accordance with Council Meetings and Councillor Workshops Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. So thank you to those who are watching along at home and to those who have been in attendance in the gallery. PM. City Council.